Hello, Kristen.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing all right. How are things in D.C.?
Things in D.C. are okay. Actually, I haven't been in D.C. very much this week. I was just up in New York at this conference, Personal Democracy Forum, where a bunch of bloggers and tech advocates and organizers all got together, people from all around the world, talking about how to use new media, blogging, social media, to change the world. It was very neat.
You know, it's always been, I think, a fairly non-ideological, non-partisan conference, but I've actually never gone, so I wouldn't be the expert on the subject. But I sense that maybe there's more conservative presence there than there has been in the past.
This is my first year going, so but I don't think that accounts necessarily for a shift in an increase in the number of conservatives. I perceived it to be a far more lefty conference. I mean, not overtly, but so, for instance, Kirsten Gillibrand spoke, and I didn't hear any sort of complaints or grumbling from any of my conservative colleagues. However, Jason Chaffetz also spoke, and sort of at the end of his remarks, I heard a lot of grumbling around me, like people frustrated that someone would be invited to speak about how he uses new media when he's using new media for what they consider to be really horrible ends. So, maybe it's just the conservatives there were all just sort of conditioned to not care. I think the conference was wonderful. I would definitely go back. I think they do a really good job of trying to keep politics out of it as much as they can.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about the discussion there about certain congressman and his activity on the Twitters in a little bit. But the bigger policy news of the week is the fallout from the bad monthly jobs report that came out last Friday, combined with the Washington Post story from Wednesday profiling Treasury Secretary Geithner and reporting an anecdote that he had actively opposed a push for a second round of stimulus in somewhat sharp tones to former White House economist Christina Romer, who was pushing for that stimulus, and Geithner called it sugar, essentially saying that the economy had to heal on its own at that point, and if anything that the government should do would be to push deficit reduction. So that certainly has confirmed a lot of skepticism about the White House's economic team in the liberal blogosphere. You have over at the America blog, John Aravosis writes, Timothy Geithner's plan to lose the 2012 election. Paul Krugman dug up the Geithner New York Times op-ed from last year, which was titled Welcome to the Recovery. If you might recall, Geithner actually complained that he didn't pick that headline, but nevertheless, it was designed to say that they were moving on the right track. Digby used that as pushback to the notion that the president had no choice, that he was hamstrung by Congress not to be able to do anymore. And she writes, I'm sure people will say that he had no choice because the presidency is a very weak office. It only has the power it has, except to wage war unilaterally. That the only power it has is to gently beg the Congress for permission to adopt its agenda. This, however, is not true. Others will say that there is no point in pursuing further stimulus because the Congress wouldn't pass it. But if this account is true, the pivot to deficit reduction wasn't a political surrender. It was a policy choice going back to 2009, pointing to this Washington Post profile of Geithner. So, and you have in the less strident corners of the blogosphere, Felix Salmon, who blogs at Reuters, also very critical. It's pretty clear that Geithner's actions have resulted in less stimulus and a weaker social safety net. I'm particularly interested in the rancor within the White House on this question, given that I thought there was consensus on the issue in terms of what the best policy should be. Pay for a second stimulus now with the proceeds of a credible long-term deficit reduction strategy. But now it seems like Geithner, for one, is actually quite vehemently opposed to any second stimulus, even in the context of long-term fiscal reform. In this debate, Romer is right and Geithner is wrong, so on and so forth. So you have pretty broad consensus in the liberal/left of center blogosphere. if there's maybe a little bit of quibbling whether the president is personally culpable for Geithner's view, I wonder if the conservative take on all this is slightly different.
So the conservative take, I guess starting off over at Hot Air, you have Ed Morrissey, who his headline is WAPO, gee, Geithner has really hit his stride, hasn't he? Calling it a fawning profile of Barack Obama's last remaining economic advisor from the start of his administration. Goldfarb asserts that Geithner has increased his influence after a disastrous start to his tenure as Secretary of the Treasury, but that may well be addition by subtraction as everyone else has bailed on Obamanomics. And then begins really takes Geithner to task for the management of TARP. He says the biggest task Geithner has undertaken was management of TARP, and that hasn't exactly covered the administration in glory. Its special Inspector General reported that Geithner's management under TARP destroyed tens of thousands of jobs by closing GM and Chrysler dealerships, for instance, and warned that that TARP and other Obamanomics policies would prolong the housing market depression. Obviously not a lot of love for Geithner, despite these findings that he was a voice opposed to a second stimulus. And so then you sort of get into what are the political ramifications of these increasingly scary economic numbers. And you have Ala Pundit at Hot Air, who a lot of conservative bloggers have been pushing around a clip of Dick Durbin, who has now sort of come out and said the headline of this post is, Dick Durbin, I can't help but think Obama might be held responsible for this economy. Imagine that. And so Ala Pundit says, I'm being cute with the headline, mainly in light of Robert Reich's dopey claim that voters will blame incumbents for the economy instead of just Obama and his party. Durbin's take is more realistic for now. And he says that, it's the idea of could Democrats have the morning in America message or the don't change horses midstream message, and it sounds like Democrats are going to attempt to pursue this don't change horses midstream message. But the morning in America message, as surreal as it is in these circumstances, is actually better because it at least implies a dramatic change to come. As it is, it just looks like we'd be wading into a deeper river. But on the other hand, it's not just Democrats and Geithner who have been talking economy, those are not the only economic topics. You have Republicans who have been coming out with the jobs and growth agenda that's become a recent sort of push out of the right. And there's a post at Bloomberg View by Ramesh Panuru who sort of throws up the caution flag that Republicans who are now, beginning to get on what I believe is the correct message politically, rather than just chasing spending, they're getting back to economy, they're getting back to jobs. But they don't necessarily have total credibility it's going to make it challenging for them to build up political steam on. Panuru's post says that in recent years, though Republicans have tried to cut taxes for corporations and high earners, without doing anything for the middle class, anything direct, that is. The middle class was told it would benefit from higher growth. It's not surprising, then, that the Republican advantage on taxes has declined, or that in recent elections, most voters haven't told pollsters that Republicans are in touch with people like them. Republicans haven't learned the lessons of their success under Reagan or the failure under Bush. The country's fiscal straits may make it difficult for Republicans to devise conservative ways of responding to the economic challenges that middle-class Americans must now face. But it must be said, they don't appear to be trying very hard. So really kind of taking Republicans to task for not hitting the right notes or having a lot of credibility for this growth agenda that they're running on. And then this was sort of followed up by, I thought, a really good post by Raihan Salam at National Review's The Agenda, where he says, Ramesh's latest column for Bloomberg View is very sobering. I strongly recommend it. It is particularly sobering in light of Tim Pawlenty's address on the economy, which I think at first glance strains credulity. He then posts, it's a narrative of a family, a husband and wife in their mid-50s, blue-collar suburb of St. Louis, husband's lost his job, having a hard time finding another one, wife is working steadily, but is having to draw on her retirement savings, they've got a son who's graduated and doesn't have a job. So a conservative presidential candidate has to keep them and their non-tragic but not entirely cheerful narrative in mind and actually make the connection between this broad growth agenda and how that's actually going to help middle-class families. So I think that's the challenge that Republicans are now facing, is how do you connect your goals of, say, 5% GDP growth to something that feels more personal?
There's certainly a lot of, there's a sense on the left, and there's always a pessimistic streak on the left, that this is disastrous for Obama's reelection prospects and trying to appeal to the president to shift course on that basis. And they may actually have had some success to that. We just got, there's a leak today that the White House is considering proposing a payroll tax cut for employers to make it less expensive to hire. And either that would successfully get through Congress because Republicans are partial to business tax cuts, or Republicans would oppose it on partisan grounds, and the president could say they're the ones being obstructionist. So you know, that pushback is certainly having an impact, it would seem. You know, the blogosphere cry seems to be trickling up to White House ears, but at the same time, you don't necessarily see this panic reflected in the totality of the poll numbers. Yes, you see the president's numbers have dropped in the past week since the jobs numbers came out, and we have one poll showing that he'd be competitive with Mitt Romney, although Obama still beats every other named candidate, although Romney has the highest name ID, so perhaps you should give that more weight. But still competitive. It's not blowout, even though the unemployment is high and the economy has been struggling for a while. Then you look at the CBS poll that came out overnight. It said, who do you approve of the president's handling of the federal budget deficit? He gets 30%, pretty weak number. But Republicans in Congress get 19%. So you still have a pretty deep skepticism of both parties. And the president's numbers, generally speaking, always tend to be higher than everybody else's. So he still seems to maintain a minimum bond with the public that prevents him from really cratering, whereas Republicans don't seem to have achieved, a modicum of support for the middle of the country.
I think that the likability issue is a big one. I mean, I think, you know, despite the fact that Obama, in terms of policy, has not really won over many friends in the public, you know, I still think, and this is, I guess, just a theory, but I think that Americans who are in the center are still sort of rooting for Obama to pull this one out. Like, they really would prefer for the economy to get better. They're rooting for Obama to be the guy that they voted for, to show them why they put hope in him. And I think because of that reservoir of hope and goodwill, even as people become dissatisfied with his policies, there's still a favorability issue, because there's, you know, pollsters will ask two different types of questions. They'll ask job approval, or do you approve of someone's handling an issue? But then there's also favorability, that more personal aspect. And I think Obama hasn't done anything, I believe, to, you know, turn independents into personally disliking him as a human being. And I think, and you sort of saw this with the Bush administration, too. For a while, George W. Bush's approval numbers were really low, but he still had decent favorability that I think coasted him through for a while. Just like George W. Bush as the guy you would get a beer with wasn't totally as disliked. That eroded toward the end of his presidency, but I think Obama is really still benefiting from, if you asked a favorable, unfavorable of Obama, you'd probably see independents with a higher favorable for him than a variety of Republican foils. And so I think he's still benefiting from that. But you've got this ABC Washington Post poll where if you look at independents, I mean, 66% or two-thirds, I believe is either 66 or 67, said that they disapprove of Obama's handling of the economy. And over half, it was strongly disapproved. I mean, those are really terrible numbers. And so I had this conversation with many folks at the conference. They were trying to figure out, you know, is Obama, he's a sure bet for winning nomination, right? Or winning the presidency back, you know, regardless of who the Republicans put up to lose against him. And no, I think Obama's very vulnerable, but I also don't think Republicans should be running a victory lap either, because we have to have some sort of credibility on the economy too. And we need to have a credible solution that addresses the middle class. And that means explaining why a corporate tax cut would create jobs for the middle class. And we like to just stop at the tax cut and don't like to explain the next pieces of the argument.
If Republicans want to take any advice from me, a post that I just wrote over at ourfuture.org, taking a shot at Pawlenty's economic plan and Romney's nascent economic plan, which tracks Pawlenty's at least in direction, although the specifics aren't there. You know, they're both based on, you know, will spur growth through tax cuts to business and the wealthy. And I think it's incumbent upon them to explain, and this is true for Republicans generally, I mean, most, you know, people have short memories, but not that short. People remember that the Bush economy was a bad one. And people, we still talk about Bush tax cuts, so that's still fresh in people's minds what those are.
Mm-hmm.
I think you gotta have an explanation why that didn't work. Otherwise, you just seem as if you're just, you know, playing the same old saws. You have to have some, you know, I mean, when Clinton became president, he had some kind of critique about, you know, this was how the Democratic policies have failed in the past. This is why I'm not going to repeat them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Obama has had lines like that as well. And I haven't seen it from the Republican that says, you know what, this didn't work. We know why it didn't work, and therefore we're doing something that's still generally conservative, but it's different in this way. And I've yet to see any kind of self-accounting.
I think the other issue that Republican candidates have broadly is conservative skepticism that government should be engineering economic outcomes in the first place. So while, you know, Democrats can come out and say, you know, we want to implement certain policies that will try to generate X amount of economic growth, when a Republican says it, loaded into that is the belief that the executive and the federal government can institute policies that will guarantee growth. And sort of as when we talk in a later topic about the bailout, there are, in general, I think conservatives are skeptics of being able to tell exactly what government can or should do to guarantee a certain outcome compared to what would the counterfactual, the status quo, if there was not a certain policy.
Why don't we segue to the bailout now? We'll suffer through Wienergate in the next topic. certainly the auto bailout is becoming a prime message for the White House, where they could point to something to say, even if you are frustrated about the overall direction of the economy, you can still look at one of our chief actions as a tangible example of what government action, our leadership in the face of a lot of skepticism did for the economy, saved jobs, saved the industry, kept the industrial Midwest from falling off the cliff. So they're driving that very hard. They're visiting a lot of auto plants in Ohio and Michigan. And they got a little bit of pushback from the Washington Post Fact Checker series, which accused them of playing with the numbers, in particular in describing how much money the taxpayer would save, only talking about or emphasizing the part that that President Obama put into the auto companies and downplaying the part that President Bush put in, because if you add them together, then you don't end up for a net profit, you know, for the American people, although still the amount of direct loss you get is still pretty minimal relative to the number of jobs you save. So I don't think it undercuts the entirety of the argument, but that wasn't the Washington Post point. That got both direct push, pushback to the pushback, or on the White House blog, there were the communications directors, Dan Pfeiffer, has a post called Fact Checking the Fact Checker, headline with the lead being, "No one's perfect, not even the anointed fact checkers who take on the admirable and valuable task when public officials accountable. Sometimes in their zeal for accountability, they get ahead of themselves in the facts." Basically, the Washington Post story was suggesting that Obama didn't have a real choice. It's sort of just an extension of what Bush initially did. And Dan Pfeiffer writes, "President Obama had a choice. He could have extended billions of dollars of taxpayer support without requiring any real changes. You could have also allowed the companies to collapse, which, because they're closely linked to networks of suppliers, dealers, and other auto companies, would have had a dramatic ripple effect through the industry. Instead, he chose a different way, standing behind the auto industry, but requiring companies to undergo painful restructuring to become competitive to the future." Perhaps a slightly less partisan defense of the White House came from Jared Bernstein, who was until recently in the White House. His official title was Joe Biden's chief economist, and was certainly seen as a liaison to the progressive economic community, because he came from the Liberal Economic Policy Institute. Now he's at Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, and his new blog there, JaredBernsteinBlog.com, is certainly becoming a go-to. But the White House gave the White House three Pinocchios. That's their 1-5 scoring system for their fact-checker series. Bernstein writes, at most half a Pinocchio. As I note below, you could object to the president's emphasis on one point if you want to be churlish about it. But the big picture, this restructuring has been a pretty dramatic success so far. There's simply no way you could call this, quote, one of the most misleading collections of assertions we've ever seen in a short presidential speech, which was how the Post characterizes it. First, the Post objects to the president's claim that Chrysler has repaid every dime and more. And Bernstein says, okay, I could see where he could have added, quote, half of what was borrowed under the previous administration or something. What the president said is true, and not nearly as egregious as the most misleading collection, etc. And for the record, if were not for the president's decision to help Chrysler, Bush's $4 billion would almost certainly have been lost. Simply put, Obama's decision saved Chrysler from liquidation. And then goes on to say other ways in which the president was right in the bigger picture and the Post was wrong. So, they're not going to let that argument go. I do think they have a lot of facts on their side, even if they, perhaps push the envelope a little bit on some of the numbers. I don't think it undercuts the main point what they're trying to say. And certainly, they seem to be having some success going to these auto plants in the Midwest and making their case where the workers there seem particularly grateful. And I know today Romney's going to be in Michigan. The auto workers there are planning to hound him for opposing the bailout in the first place. I take it, again, the conservatives are not celebrating what the bailout did for the auto industry.
Well, and I'm wondering to what a quick question. I'm wondering to what extent the administration is really hinging a lot of, when they're putting together their reelection strategy, to what extent reinvigorating unions, despite the fact that card check didn't wind up happening and, not all teachers' unions love things like Race to the Top. And you just had Obama choose a new political director took somebody, the chief of staff from the Department of Labor. Do you think that, this is a particularly helpful narrative for Obama because labor will be very important? Or do you think that this is a narrative that has, if he is able to sell the bailout as a success, which many independents and very much conservatives, not fans of bailouts, do you think that this has appeal outside of workers who are directly saved?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think there's definitely a chord struck by the notion that America doesn't make anything anymore. And Obama very much wants to be seen as a Make It in America president. So that stirs, I think emotional, patriotic feelings beyond the individuals who had their jobs saved, both individuals in the auto plants and in the related industries like suppliers. So for Obama to say, I bet on America's ability to make something. I took the hits up front. I took those slings and arrows, and I stood by our workers, and it paid off. I think that has broader appeal beyond, the union aspect of it. Now, certainly the White House walks a fine line on the union front. Clearly, union support is a key component of any Democratic coalition, but certainly unions take their knocks from some political independence. So, the White House has always been careful not to, or at least try not to be seen as simply in the pocket of one constituency. For example, they're pushing very hard on these trade deals, Colombia, Panama, and Korea, which most unions are not for, although they did pick off some union support for Korea. But they're adding to that mix, okay, Republicans, we are trying to get these free trade agreements through, but you have to also expand assistance to the workers who get displaced from free trade agreements. This program called Trade Adjustment Assistance, which Republicans are balking at. So it's that kind of dual messaging that they're generally striving for. And I think the education piece is separate from that. I think the White House seems to have no problem being a thorn in the side of it as having broad, moderate, independent appeal. And if the teachers' unions aren't happy about it, that's just that's a feature, not a bug, I think, on that score for them.
A post, Megan McArdle, she says, I find it a little hard to understand why liberal columnists are so excited about the GM deal. E.J. Dionne's column from this weekend was very indignant that the GOP wasn't recognizing this outstanding success. What lesson exactly are we supposed to learn from this success? What question did it answer? Can the government keep giving Can the government keep companies operating if it is willing to give them a virtually interest-free loan of $50 billion and a tax-free gift of $20 billion or so? I don't think that was really in dispute. When all is said and done, we will probably have given them a sum equal to its 2007 market cap. No, the question is not whether GM could make a profit after a bankruptcy that stiffed most of its creditors. The question is whether it was worth it to the taxpayer to burn roughly $10 to $20 billion in order to give the company another shot at life. To put that in perspective, GM had about 75,000 hourly workers before the bankruptcy. We could have given each of them a cool $250,000 and still come out well ahead compared to the ultimate cost of the bailout, including the tax breaks. And if we'd have done that, we'd have saved ourselves in other ways. We would have reduced some of the overcapacity that plagues the global industry. We would not have seen the government throwing its weight into a bankruptcy proceeding to redistribute monies from creditors to pensioners, which isn't a good precedent. But even if you think the bailout was a good idea, there's something you should consider before we celebrate the administration's Solomonic wisdom. The Obama administration's rush to dispose of its GM stake before the 2012 election is probably costing us billions. Because she goes through, you know, at what point, you know, our government's decisions to sell the stock, at what price, like what does that mean for it? You also have Jim Manzi, who, and this is a position that he took on the stimulus and continues to take now with the bailout, is it's difficult, if not impossible, to make claims about how many jobs saved or how much, economic damage was prevented by a certain policy. Because in order to do that, you're doing a comparative. You're doing, this is what happened as a result of the policy, and here is what we think probably would have happened if we hadn't put that policy into place. And generally believes that even our best economists are not very good at concocting what a hypothetical would have been situation is. So Manzi's piece over at The Corner, he says, Megan McArdle's done consistently excellent reported pieces on the GM bailout. Her recent evaluation of its net effect on the U.S. Treasury is no exception. Her bottom line is that the deals caused U.S. taxpayers to burn $10 to $20 billion. This is in line with the Obama administration's $14 billion estimate of the net cost of the Treasury, as reported in the Wall Street Journal. If anything, I think this understates the case on the direct cost because it doesn't consider other direct transfers of economic value like government support for Delphi that inflated the value of the asset that GM sold to create a big chunk of their headline profits the past quarter. He says, but no matter what realistic direct bailout costs you estimate, the objection of bailout defenders is that it is dwarfed by other receipts or avoided expenditures that would have been created by the bailout, things like unemployment insurance, lost tax receipts. But Manzi says, to this point, it's not really so simple. You can't compare all of these net tax receipts or more broadly economic activity to what would happen in the, quote, world as it is today minus GM. That in the event of bankruptcy, you don't burn down the factories, erase all the source code on the hard disks, and make it illegal to use the brand name Chevrolet. Others take ownership of the assets. The employees go on with their lives. Some of these assets will be put to use generating revenues, profits, taxes. Other former employees will go get other jobs or start businesses generating revenues. It's tough to say that in the world without GM that we would have an exact, you can just subtract GM's contribution to the economy and say, oh, if it wasn't here, the economic situation would be status quo minus GM. Those employees would go get other jobs.
That conclusion presumes there's lots of other jobs.
It doesn't presume that everybody...
We just suffer huge job losses.
Presume that every single one of those workers would go get another job, but it doesn't presume that none of those workers, that all of those workers would sit at home on their couches doing nothing all day. It presumes that you can't know that, that that is an unknowable fact. He's not making an estimate of what he thinks would have happened. He's saying you can't know that if nobody was able to buy GM cars, that then they wouldn't therefore be buying Fords, or they wouldn't be buying Toyotas that are made in the United States. You know, it's saying that...
I accept you can't know the exact numbers. It's not just a straight line, but we have less jobs today than in 2007 after the financial crisis, and we're struggling to create those jobs again. We have a huge gap between available unemployed workers and jobs available. So whatever the exact number is, it would be worse than today. It would be worse than the current situation because there's not a surfeit of jobs where people just simply ease into.
Well, he says, second, some of the profit the GM makes today would have been made by other companies that would have picked up the slack if the company lost market share after a bankruptcy. They would pay taxes on those profits. As far as government receipts are concerned, money is money. How would the auto industry structure evolve over time? And he says anybody, all he's saying is that, this is the quote from his post, anybody who tells you they can answer all of these questions reliably is full of it. And that doesn't even get into the long run considerations of what effects this has on the rule of law or moral hazard, or if you want to make the case for the bailout, social solidarity and the degradation of the working class. So,
I mean, you could say anyone who can answer any question about anything reliably is full of it. The world is full of uncertainty. But these all seem to suffer from, you know, the classic line that we've mentioned in the past: if you're explaining, you're losing.
Yes.
I mean, and it's not to say this is a simple debunking of what's being said, but the headlines are that GM and Chrysler and Ford are doing well, following actions that the president took. And when the president took those actions, conservatives were saying this was going to be an economic calamity. So to have to shift from that and to say, well, it's not as good as they're making it out to be.
I don't think Republicans said that because the government was giving Chrysler and GM a lot of free money that it was going to create an economic calamity. I think they're saying it's going to set a really bad precedent.
Even that's a hard argument to make when the companies are doing all right now.
Well, of course the companies are doing all right, though. I mean, if I wanted to start a company and the government was going to, and I wasn't going to run it particularly well, and the government was going to give me billions of dollars, then I sure as heck better be able to, like, fix the problem because I got this really generous gift from the federal government. I mean, that's the point that McArdle makes, is she says that everybody's championing, or that everybody's, like, cheerleading because GM is not in the toilet, where she says, you know, I don't think the argument ever was that GM and Chrysler were going to remain totally in the toilet.
I think the argument was, if the government gets involved, they're going to screw it up because the government sucks.
That was the argument
going into this whole thing.
Well, yeah, that the government tends to be really bad at running businesses. That is correct. And so then you have another counterfactual, you know, okay, so let's say that GM and Chrysler had just been allowed go bankrupt, you know, no government involvement. Then who's to say that after a restructuring without government involvement, maybe the company would have reformed in a better way? I mean, again, all that we're saying is that this is just, it's all hypotheticals, and it just makes it very difficult to assert that because the government did something that I think is a kind of a no-brainer would allow a company to at least rebound somewhat, that it's tough to make the case that, like, our thinking on this and that bailing out companies is a good way for us to continue saving jobs in the future.
I mean, I don't even think the president would make that argument. I mean, no one was arguing this as a way to go about your daily business. This is an exceptional circumstance.
But by touting this as a policy win, you're sort of saying that when we look at a troubled industry, the government can come in and save it, and that generates a good outcome, which does sound like it's setting a precedent and does sound like a potential predictor or statement of what future action might look like. If you're proud of a policy, doesn't it stand to reason that you would be likely in similar circumstances to do it again?
Oh, in similar circumstances, yes. I mean, the hope, of course, you don't get into a lot of similar circumstances. I don't think that's what the president is trying to say.
Okay.
Now, you make the argument that that might be the end result of it. But I think the underlying message of what he's trying to say is, you know, beyond, you know, we bet on the American worker, we believe in making things in America, but he also just wants to make an argument about government competence. That when the government does get involved in strategic ways, balancing all the considerations, not willy-nilly, not in every circumstance, but when appropriate, we are able to do a good job. We're not inherently all thumbs. Going back to the presidential primaries when, some folks on the left knocked Obama for saying he wanted to be like Reagan and essentially being a transformational president, he followed that by saying he wanted to make government cool again. That was his end goal. Not that he wanted to replicate Reagan's policies, but he wanted to, you know, change the look of American government in the eyes of the American people as something to be proud of, and that was good at what they did. And so I think that's very much what he wants to accomplish here. Not that he want now for a conservative that might strike panic because if people think the Americans good at things, they might start doing more things. But I think Obama's trying to balance that, I mean, balance the message that the government is competent with a notion that the government's not necessarily going to get involved in everyone's lives.
Well, the trends were going in Obama's direction, at least up until, I believe, it was about 2006. Pew does this study where they talk to young people. They ask these questions of everybody, but they segmented out young people. And they asked this question, do you tend to believe that when the government does something, or do you believe that when the government does something, it tends to be ineffective and wasteful? And that back in, like, the 80s, These numbers were pretty high for all age groups. People thought, yeah, when the government does something, it tends to be inefficient and wasteful. And that now when you ask it, two-thirds of young people don't, and this isn't now, this is like 5 years ago, but when you'd asked it, young people didn't think the government was inefficient and wasteful, that they generally thought government could be used as a force of good. I would love to see what that number is now and if faith in the federal government has fallen off. But at least up until 2006, Obama's dream of government being cool again was sort of on the right track. So,
well, we have about 10 minutes.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Before I have to jump. So we probably can get to all of our exciting topics. Should we suffer Wienergate?
No.
So there's the debit card fee issue and the so-called SWAT raid.
I'll do the SWAT raid really fast, just because I don't know to what extent the liberal blogosphere was really getting exercised about it. But there was a post, this is sort of an alliance between Reason.com, Hit and Run, and Red State, where there's a story that there was a woman who had skipped out on her student loans and I guess was being investigated by, the story was later updated that she's being investigated by the Department of Education for student loan fraud. I have never known what the policy is for someone who commits student loan fraud, not being someone who's interested in committing student loan fraud. But it turns out, I was a little surprised to discover, that the Department of Education has its own SWAT team-like law enforcement task force. And so in this particular story in California, it was originally reported that a SWAT team came to the house to deliver a search warrant. The SWAT team stormed the house, broke down the door, handcuffed the husband, stuck around for 6 hours, put the kids in the car in a police car until it was successfully pointed out that not only was the woman not there in the house, she had skipped out on her family too. And so the frustration is among libertarians and conservatives alike. One, why is it okay to kick in someone's door at 6 a.m. on a Tuesday because of student loan fraud, which is not really a dangerous crime per se, and so that's what gets the libertarians exercised about, you know, why do we need this sort of paramilitary operation to come after this woman? On the other hand, why does the Department of Education have the ability to execute a raid like that? And so the Department of Education was in touch with Matt Welch over at Reason Hit and Run. He said, just received an email this morning from Department of Education Deputy Press Secretary Darren Briscoe in regard to this morning's news that a SWAT team was sent to execute a warrant on the estranged husband of a student loan defaulter. And the statement says, while it was reported in local media that the search was related to a defaulted student loan, that is incorrect. It was related to a criminal investigation. The Inspector General's office does not execute search warrants for late loan payments. We can't specify in the conflict of the case, but we can say that the OIG's office conducts about 30 to 35 search warrants each year on issues like bribery, fraud, and embezzlement. And he says, this will come as relief to millennial deadbeats, but the notion that bribery, fraud, and embezzlement is all it takes to get a paramilitary squad to bang down your door at 6 a.m., handcuff you in your boxers, and throw your preteen children into the backseat of a squad car is frankly pretty terrifying. I guess I did not realize that the Department of Education had a law enforcement arm that could do something like this. And so conservatives who have no love for the Department of Education anyways are no doubt pushing this story around as further proof that Department of Education tend to be used for good ends that actually improve student outcomes. So that's that story. What, have you seen anything on the left about it?
Not much. There was a post from Nora Mr. Nice blog who seemed surprised at the conservative reaction to this. Headline is, would have thought Rick Santelli and all the Santellians would be cheering. Most of the blog attention from horrified right-wingers, but why? It now seems this raid was directed at someone guilty of fraud, not just student loan default, but even if it had been directed at a defaulter, shouldn't right-wingers have been delighted? Didn't they pump their fists at the Rick Santelli rant? When Santelli was going off on the deadbeats, you know, the losers' mortgages, how many people want to pay for your neighbor's mortgage that has an extra bathroom and can't pay their bills, raise their hand. You would think that you would want government enforcement of people who were defrauding taxpayers.
I don't think that's in question. I think what's in question was this particular raid being extremely excessive, that the woman wasn't even in the house and that they were still there for 6 hours.
Well, I mean, they're very well. I mean, I don't think we know all the facts about this situation. It's very possible that there's, I mean, clearly a miscommunication because the person wasn't there. So there could have been a botch in the execution of this.
I think that's
pretty clear. But that's separate from, I mean, it seems like the right is trying to make a larger political point that why does this government agency have any power at all to pursue fraud?
One of the quotes I think asked a good question, or said there was a line, one of the two posts I just referenced, said there's a line, I guess we know what the Department of Education was doing with all those shotguns then, and linking to a post that, like, the Department of Education purchased, like, why does the Department of Education need firearms? I guess this is why. To go after people who've committed loan fraud. So, anyhow, I think that's the heart of that. But
I mean, I'm still not clear from this that it's education department people with the weaponry.
Well, the local law enforcement said it wasn't us.
I mean, they're federal agents,
yes.
But I don't know if they're education department agents.
It's apparently they're within the Department of Education's Office of the Inspector General. So I don't know enough fully about it, but it sounds to me that this. It seems like it's running out of the Department of Education in a way that is confusing people and disturbing to both conservatives and libertarians alike.
Certainly, I think it'll be interesting to see when all the facts come out what the full story is. I think we have sketchy information.
I will agree with you on that one.
Well, let's leave it there. Always good to talk to you, Kristen.
Good to talk to you too, Bill.
And that will do it for this week, and we'll catch you next week on This Week in Blog. Take care.